Good evening and welcome to tonight's Silicon Valley Reads, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley and the Tech Museum of Innovation. My name is Nancy Howe, and I'm the County Librarian for Santa Clara County Library District and one of the co-chairs of Silicon Valley Reads. Tonight's program is titled Unintended Consequences. Is too much information, too fast, too much of a good thing? It's my pleasure to introduce our panel of experts. Nick Carr, writes about technology and culture for publications like the New York Times, Atlantic, and Wired. His books including The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google, and Does IT Matter have been translated into over 20 languages. Nick was a writer in residence at UC Berkeley and former member of the Encyclopedia Britannica editorial board of advisors. He holds English literature degrees from Dartmouth College and Harvard University. Nick is the author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, which was a 2011 Pulitzer Prize finalist and one of the two featured books for Silicon Valley Reads 2014. His new book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us, will be published in September. Zach Lynch is the founder and executive director of the Neurotechnology Industry Organization. He was previously a managing director and co-founder of NeuroInsights and serves on several advisory boards, including the McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT. Zach is the author of The Neuro Revolution, How Brain Science is Changing Our World, and producer of the Neurogaming Conference, which is being held in San Francisco in May. He recently developed KidStar, a playtime limit reward system app for iDevices. Zach received his degrees in evolutionary biology, environmental science, and economic geography from UCLA. Marilyn Walker is a professor of computer science at UC Santa Cruz and the associate dean of graduate studies for the Baskin School of Engineering. Professor Walker received her PhD in computer and information science from the University of Pennsylvania in 1993. Before becoming an academic in 2003, she was a principal researcher for Bell Labs. She has over 100 publications in the area of natural language processing and spoken dialogue systems. Professor Walker is the director of the Natural Language and Dialogue Systems Lab in the Baskin School of Engineering, where she is leading a large research project on dialogue in online forums and social media, working on dialogue in interactive story worlds, narrative analysis of social media weblogs. She is interested in the use of online language data for natural language applications, including learning facts about the world from social media. Moderating tonight's program is Barbara Marshman, the editorial page editor at the San Jose Mercury News. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Nicholas Carr, Zach Lynch, Marilyn Walker, and Barbara Marshman.
Thank you. What a wonderful crowd. Let me start by asking how many of you have read Nick's book? Okay, that's a good number. How many of you, put your hands up again, please, those of you who have read it. How many, those of you who read it in paper, put your hands down. Only a few people read it on a Kindle or something. That's really interesting. So I don't have to ask then, what is this? It's a book. I have to say, I mean, I'm going to ask Nick to just give us a little bit of the premise of his book for those of you who haven't read it. But I have to say, when I read it, it was one of those experiences of seeing myself in it, the way you sometimes do with a great novel. I saw my mind in this book. And I was so relieved because I was getting worried about early Alzheimer's. the scattered attention, the disconnectedness. So this is going to be fascinating for me. So Nick, could you tell us about it in maybe 140 characters?
Only if you retweet what I said. The book comes out of my own experience. I've been a technology writer for a long time, so most of my life was a big technology enthusiast. But a few years ago, I began to notice something disconcerting about the way I was thinking. And in brief, I was having trouble concentrating. And I began to realize that even when I was away from computers and cell phones and everything else, I still craved to have the kind of stimulation we get when we're looking at a computer screen, when we're connected, when we're online. And that made me wonder, you know, this is a kind of unusual technology in the history of the human race, because at this point we're interacting with the internet, interacting with the online world, with computers, all day long. From the moment often we get up, a lot of people, first thing they do is look at a screen of some type, and then they're interacting with it all through the day until they go to bed. And so I began to wonder, you know, what is the effect of this on our minds, on the way we think? And to put it in a nutshell, I think it's pretty clear that human beings have a deep instinct to try to gather all the information about everything that's going on around them. And this, you can see this in the kind of brain chemistry that goes on when we find a bit of information. And you can explain it by looking into the past about how we evolved and how it helped you stay alive if you knew everything that was going on around you. But we've created, through computer technology and internet technology, we've created an environment that we live in where there's no end to the new information that's available all the time. So I think we bring this instinct, this craving for information, into this new world, and we can't turn it off. We find ourselves acting compulsively. We go to get new messages and new notifications, even when we know it's completely trivial. And we're always thinking about the technology. And the problem is that what we've done is we've created this environment that is beginning to squeeze out other ways of thinking. It's making it harder and harder for us to engage in reflective thinking, contemplative thinking, conceptual thinking, all the ways of thinking that actually require you to actively screen out distractions and interruptions and concentrate your mind and concentrate your attention on one thing, one train of thought, one piece of literature, one anything, for an extended period of time. So my argument is, for all the great benefits we get from the internet, and I don't have to review those because we all know them, we're sacrificing, I believe, or at least beginning to see the erosion of our capacity to engage in the kinds of thinking that until recently were considered the highest forms of human thought. And I think it's time, given the speed with which this has happened, it's time to stand back and kind of think more critically about the technology and our use of it.
Thank you. Zach, you have a little different perspective on this. I think you fundamentally agree on the science. But talk about how your view might, your concerns might differ a little bit from Nick's, and let's keep the kids till later.
Okay. With any new technology, there comes both promise and peril, and I think Nick has hit it on the head. There is tremendous economic growth that has emerged because of the internet and the flow of information in real time to all of us. Yet there is great peril. Peril in the way that we think. Peril in the way that we act. Peril in the way that we care for each other, sort of on an ongoing basis. And these technologies are changing the way that we think and act and care for each other on a moment-by-moment basis. I sort of take a broader historical view and sort of look at the world from the perspective of grand technological revolutions. So humanity has gone through an agricultural revolution, an industrial revolution, and we're definitely in the midst of an information revolution where information technologies are driving fundamental political, economic, and social change. And what I posit is that there is another technological revolution that's just beginning to take hold, and that is the neuro-revolution, where neurotechnology drives politics, drives economics, impacts art, entertainment. And with this, we will have new tools to be able to deal with some of the maladies, some of the negative consequences of today's technology, just as information technology and its flourishing has allowed us to deal with some of the downsides of, let's say, electrification, oil, or the motorization and oil in the economy. So new technologies will emerge that will hopefully allow us, and I believe they're emerging now, and we can get into that a little bit later, that will allow us to attenuate some of these negative consequences in perhaps profound ways that may even deepen our capacity to think in thoughtful ways and grow our capacity to think in novel ways.
Thank you. And Marilyn, I think you are perhaps a little farther out on the edge of really enjoying all this without as many concerns. Am I right?
I think it's clear that people need to maybe manage their attention, learn how to manage their attention in a way that perhaps they didn't have to in the past. But I'd like to focus on, I mean, I'm here because I'm a technologist, I'm a computer scientist. I find technology very interesting, and how and the pace of innovation right now is very exciting to me. And I see a lot of benefits with this information overload kind of scenario that Nick talks about. So one of the things I'd like to focus on is, you know, where there are societal benefits and also personal benefits to having a lot of information available that you wouldn't have had in the past. So, you know, there's all the new technologies for, you know, the Fitbit and the Jawbone technologies that keep track of your activity levels. There's iPhone apps that can track how you're sleeping. You might not know that you regularly woke up in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden you have data that says that, you know, you're waking up and you're having disrupted sleep. And there's therapies that you can take advantage of that you wouldn't have been able to in the past. There's a lot of room for reflection. So one of my colleagues at Santa Cruz has developed an app that's a cognitive behavioral therapy app where it triggers you to reflect three times a day on how your day's going, how you're feeling about it, and then it brings those things back up later, and you can look over time. So they have some long-term users. You can look over time, and you can see that, you know, just before some big event, you were very, very anxious, and then it went fine, right? And so having that ability to reflect over that electronically collected data over a timeline and think about how you act in those situations, I think there can be a lot of benefit in those. And on the books question, I mean, one of the things as a book lover that I just like to throw in there is the information that's out there and the publication modes that people have available to them now are pretty exciting. You know, anybody can be a writer, anybody can publish, you know, everybody has their own, you know, personal story on the web that they can put out there. And I think that access to that mode of, you know, publication and personal analysis and stuff like journaling online, I also find that really interesting, and that's one of the areas that I've been working on with this narrative analysis. So you can go on the web and you can find one of the things that we're looking at, you know, this personal reflection. You can go on the web and you can find people's stories about personal social anxiety situations. Like we were working with one, we were looking at one recently where somebody's talking about how every time they have to go get their hair cut, they have a panic attack, and they talk about it, right? And we're looking at whether we could repurpose some of those personal stories for other people that have the same kind of problems.
Like, I see many women in this room nodding their heads.
So anyway, I see a lot of good, potential good in the technology, and that's the angle that I'd like to take.
Good. Well, one of the things I found interesting in the book was, Nick, you mentioned a Stanford study, and I think some others, that found the more time you spend looking at a screen, absorbing information from screens, the less able you are to distinguish, or the less able test subjects were to distinguish, important information from trivia. this explains a lot of what's on the net. But I'm wondering, how do you, if that is true, and I suspect it is, not just because of the conspiracy theories, but just because of the sort of jumping around that I know I do in researching things, forget what I originally was looking for, but also from the, well, let me just stop there.
The Stanford study, I think, is a very interesting one. It was published in 2009, and it looks at the researchers gathered two groups of people. One group spent a lot of time online, doing a lot of multitasking online, and another group who didn't, who spent very little time online. And then they gave them six kind of standard tests of their intellectual ability, their ability to control their thoughts and so forth. And the heavy multitaskers did worse on all six of the tests. And one of the most interesting was a test of how able you are to distinguish what's important around you from what's not. And what they found is that the more time, as you said, the more time you spend online, the less able you are to make that fundamental distinction. And I think if you step back and think about it, if you can't even figure out what's important to pay attention to, then you're in trouble at the very get-go. But what the head researcher said is that the technology seems to be turning us into suckers for distraction. And what he meant by that is what they're seeing is that the more time we spend online, the more we get attracted simply to what's new rather than what's important. And that explains, I think, a lot of the compulsive use of smartphones and so forth that we see, that you just want to know the latest thing. And that's what grabs your eyes. That's what grabs your attention. Even if you have something in front of you, maybe it's a great novel, maybe it's a conversation, an important conversation you're having with a family member, maybe it's a work of art, maybe it's your studies, that gets set aside every time the phone buzzes, every time, you know, you have even a sense that there's some new information out there. And they also found that the more you one of the other tests they gave was multitasking skill itself, and they found even there the heavy multitaskers did worse. They convinced themselves that they were good at multitasking because they had been doing it for so long, but when the researchers looked more carefully, they found that really what they were good at was having divided attention, was in shifting their focus back and forth very, very quickly. And when they analyzed the people's performance on the underlying tasks, they found that they were doing more poorly than people who weren't multitasking so much. So this is, you know, I have to say that we're still in the early stages of the scientific investigation of this phenomenon, but that's not the only experimental evidence we have, but it was one of the most compelling, that all this time that we spend in a state of distraction and interruption is beginning to have long-term effects on the way we think, and probably not beneficial ones.
So, Marilyn, do you perceive any of that in your kids today? And they're not kids, your college students today, compared to a few years ago?
I have kids, too.
Well, in your kids, then both. But your students is what I had in mind.
Well, I would kind of, as somebody, I'm really interested in technology, but in some ways I might be kind of old-fashioned. So I've always actually think it's interesting. I mean, I was around before the internet was. And I always had to, you know, I can always remember having this analogy for myself when I was trying to get something done, that I had to, like, chain my leg to my desk and sit there until I did it. So, you know, I think I always, you know, and when we first started having email at work, I never used the little XBIF thingy that would ping at you when the email would come and stuff, because I would find it too distracting. So I've always done stuff like that to manage my own attention, like have a certain time when I read my email and I don't, and things like that. So I could be weird that way. But I do see with the college kids and with the kids I teach, and also with my own teenagers, that I think they have bad work habits. So That's how I,
And are they similar in nature to this? Are they
scattered? It is this kind of interrupt-driven thing. They get used to switching back and forth between all these tasks all the time. And I couldn't tell you how many times I've told my 16-year-old twins that when you want to write an essay, the best thing to do is to take a yellow pad and go away from the computer and sit down and write down your thoughts and get them organized before you start typing anything in or, you know, doing anything on the computer. And they don't do it. I mean,
they say, what's a pad?
Yeah. You know, but that's what I do. And I still, you know, I don't use little file cards anymore, but I do when I want to think through something, you know, I always go away from the machine and just stay away from it. And I find it really annoying when, you know, I'm teaching a big lecture and they're online. it happens, right?
Zach?
Do I see this? Absolutely. I've got a 4- and a 7-year-old, and we live here in the Silicon Valley, and they're distracted by distraction all the time.
Tell us about your app while you're...
Right. So I got so fed up with having to deal with my children grabbing the iPad and running away with it, right, and playing games, that I decided to build an app called KidStar. Now, KidStar is a game time limit reward system. So what that means is I choose the amount of time that they're going to get to play, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever seems appropriate for that specific amount of time that day, and then I hand it to them, and they can do whatever they want. And they have a couple of games that they like to play, and let's say it's 30 minutes that they're allowed to play. At 20 minutes, a pop-up comes up, and it says, if you'd like to stop now, you can get 10 stars. Or you can keep playing until the end, right? And so at the end, it says, your time is up, and you get 2 stars. So they even get stars for just playing the amount of time, and then they're locked out of the iPad, okay, or the iPhone. And at that point, they collect these stars, and they can trade them in within the app for rewards. Maybe it's a movie, maybe it's a new app that they can play with, maybe it's having a friend over for the afternoon to play with, maybe it's M&Ms. You get to decide, you know your children, so you get to basically optimize that for them. And with KidStar, it was working fabulous for about a year. We were in the App Store, and about 6 weeks ago, Apple took us out of the App Store.
They caught
on. After thousands of downloads and hundreds of parents giving, you know, me nice little notes saying, thank you, you've changed my children's relationship with our technology. We were using a hack that basically use the messaging system to pop up a message every second to stop the kid from getting back into the app, basically locking you out without a password. And that was going beyond the sandbox, of the app. And so we're working on, you know, how we might, you know, tweak the app to make it fall within the boundaries of what they are doing. But yes, I mean, in my own personal life, I see this in spades, and I've sort of taken this proactive step to go out and, you know, get some software engineers and build this app so that, you know, they aren't driven to distraction and they have a set limited amount of time, but they do get rewards. So I do believe that this technology in and of itself can be used, you know, from a behavioral economics perspective to help persuade kids to act more appropriately at specific times.
I have a question from the audience that says, Zach, why are you giving your children the iPad in the first place?
Oh, I don't give it to them. They take it. They're very sneaky.
This is also from the audience. Could one of you discuss the brain chemistry involved in the addictive nature of handheld devices? Nick, you get into it a little bit. Do you want to?
Yeah, I mean, as I understand it, what brain scientists have discovered is that when we get a new piece of information or even seek a new piece of information, there's a release of dopamine in our brains. And dopamine is a very important neurotransmitter chemical, very important for regulating brain function. but it's a pleasure-producing chemical. So what it does is it encourages you to repeat whatever action you're doing when there's the release of dopamine. And dopamine is implicated in, as you can imagine, various addictions, because in the worst-case scenario, you get rewarded for doing something that it's really not good for you to do. And so I think that is the one of the reasons, at least, that we find it so compelling and often so compulsive to constantly check our devices, particularly, you know, little smartphones or whatever that are always connected and therefore always available to get new information. It's kind of a reward system in our brain that encourages us to just keep doing it because it's pleasurable.
Have you done any work on that at all, Zach?
No, I'm not a neuroscientist personally, but Nick has hit the nail on the head. It's the D word. It's dopamine, and it comes in nice little floods and flashes, and it keeps us checking that phone day in and day out.
What about individual differences?
There are always individual differences, and I think that's a good point, because obviously when you talk about the effects of any technology or anything in society, you have to talk in generalities, and I think there are, I'm sure there are differences even when you get down to, you know, how much dopamine is released, but there are also differences in how people react to the technology. So I think there are plenty of people for whom being constantly connected, constantly, you know, bombarded with information is great. You know, these people would never have a contemplative moment in their lives anyway, so you might as well get it. And I, you know, I don't mean to make fun of them because
it literally feels good, right?
Yeah. I mean, right. And so yeah, I mean, if that's the way you think and that's the way you're productive, then you're going to be happy, and you're going to find it very hard to even relate to the kinds of criticisms that I and other people make, because that way of thinking, the contemplative, reflective way of thinking, just doesn't enter into your conception of your mind.
Yeah, like in the introversion, extroversion personality dimension, they, you know, there's studies that show that there's differences in the dopamine receptors in the brain that correlate with the external measures of personality, introversion, extroversion. And, for example, introverts have less, you know, there's biological basis for it. Introverts have a stronger reaction to lemon juice, you know, than extrovert. So I could see on a dimension, you know, that somebody whose kind of natural perfect job would be like to be out there in the public eye and talking all the time and selling things or, you know, that kind of thing would maybe be more likely to want to be constantly connected, and another person, you know, who would have a more contemplative life would not, would be managing it maybe like the way like I describe myself, like I always am trying to manage my input so that I don't have too much coming at me.
But, and I think that's right, but while some of it is certainly innate, I think there are learned factors, learned behaviors that enter into it. And so, particularly when you push the technology on really young kids, what ends up happening is that you're not giving them the opportunity to ever be alone with their thoughts for very long. Because, you know, when I was growing up, sometimes you couldn't socialize. Your friends weren't around. You sat in your room. You were kind of bored. And then finally you amused yourself and you kind of – and that opened up certain possibilities in certain ways, certain contemplative and reflective ways of thinking. If you have a cell phone and you're able to text or get onto Facebook, you never are not socializing. The moment you're by yourself and you're bored, you pull out the phone and you start socializing or run apps or whatever. So I do think beyond the whatever's innate in us, we also train ourselves in a way in how to think. And you kind of have to learn to be reflective and contemplative. And if you don't get the opportunity to do that, then it's going to be tough to learn those kinds of skills.
I'd like to ask the audience, like with my kids, they didn't have their own phones until they could be out independent for hours after school, and I needed to track them. So I don't... I'm just wondering, really, how much things have changed. Like, we had a limit on how much television we were allowed to watch when I was a child, you know. I mean, if you're going to let your kids sit in front of the television from the moment they come home after school until they go to bed at night, that seems like pretty much the same kind of thing you're talking about. So, so that the difference is what Zach was saying about the accessibility, that the devices are portable and they could, you know, you could grab an iPad and go hide under a bed with it or something
they
like
do.
That. But, you know, but I used to, you know, take a flashlight to bed with me so I could read. I mean, I'm not sure that the world has really changed that much. I mean, I think the technology is there, and maybe parents just, as I would never let a little, I mean, I see my neighbors do it, but I wouldn't.
Well, I mean, the average teenager now sends or receives 3,500 texts a month. And that's something like a text every 6 minutes of their waking life. And obviously, they don't come every 6 minutes. They're in clusters and stuff. But I think it's pretty clear that we're pushing cell phone technology to ever younger ages very, very quickly. And so I agree with you that it would be nice if you could control kids' use of that. But usually what happens is, you know, they get the cell phone, they run up an incredible bill in text messages, and they get then their parents immediately give them an all you can text plan, and then they're off and running. And that's
I was not having had children, and I thought, well, their parents take away the cell phone, right? But no.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, though, I mean, with any technology, there's both promise and peril. So where's the positive here? Are we going to have new ways of thinking? Are we able to combine information? Are our kids able to combine information in fundamentally new ways and at such speeds that we can create new ways of creating value? And I think the jury's still out there. I know, you know, in my own personal life and business life, the fact that I have access to so much information does allow me to sort of combine ideas in new ways much more effectively and quickly than I was capable of doing 10 years ago. But to Nick's point, how many books do I read each year? It's been cut in half, 50% over the past decade, definitely. And it's not peaking up, unfortunately.
What do you read? What do you do instead of read books?
Oh, terrible things like the New York Times app and Huffington Post, and you know, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it's data feeding, right? But it's short snippets. It's not deep, thoughtful, contemplative, right? Works of art or, you know, pieces of literature.
Zach, you mentioned earlier you look forward to the development of technology that might help us deal with this and take it to a more positive level than it is now. Could you give us a sense of what you're talking about?
Yeah, right. So I've been tracking over the past decade a new sort of industry sector called neurosoftware, which is really software companies that are embedding principles of neuroscience into the applications themselves. And this has been primarily emerging in the area of memory impairment, some of the brain fitness applications that many of us are sort of using. I mean, 50 million people worldwide have now used Lumosity's brain fitness application. I think these are just at the very beginning. There's some pretty sophisticated neuroscientists at Johns Hopkins, at Duke, at MIT that are spinning out companies now. And in fact, I'm bringing them together next month in San Francisco for a neurogaming conference. if you can imagine that word, right? And the idea there is really, how do you leverage what we know about attention, what we know about learning, and how do you make learning engaging, leveraging sort of the latest knowledge around game mechanics in a profound way to be able to teach kids in a world that are constantly bombarded by this idea or that idea, that piece of information. So we've got it's kind of warfare, right? It's an arms race. We've got to keep up with their technology and how they're dealing with it. And I see that coming along. Mm-hmm. One of the sessions is on educational neurogaming, which will be specifically focused on how you create technologies to educate kids in the 21st century, leveraging what we know about the brain and how we learn.
That leads us actually to a question a couple of folks in the audience had. I read one. There's a trend in my school for teachers to incorporate technology into their teaching. It's seen as being innovative and guaranteeing student engagement. What do you think of this is the question. I go beyond what are the good and bad things to look for in incorporating technology in school? Obviously, the kids, you know, are good at using these machines and like to use them, but at what point is that, what are the limits of that in education? You want to start, Nick?
Sure. I think, unfortunately, I think for a long time, people, parents, school boards, educators, in some cases, not all, but certainly, have tended to confuse the technological intensity of a school with the quality of the school. And it's kind of a simplistic way to make you feel good about your school if suddenly everybody gets an iPad or a tablet of some sort. And, you know, to pick up on what Zach was saying, there are ways you can design the technology to be a very powerful learning tool. But you actually have to think through each application of the technology to each class or to each particular learning environment. And too often we simply say, well, more technology has got to be better. And in fact, what you find out is that often, you know, there's this ideal that parents have or that school boards have or whatever about how kids will use technology. And, you know, you think, oh, they're going to get this iPad and they're going to really, you know, study with it and they're going to do their homework on it. And then, you know, you look at how actually kids use it. It's very different. They have a bunch of conversations going on simultaneously and they're checking Instagram and Facebook and stuff. And maybe in one corner they got a little bit of homework going. And so the sense that we need more technology in schools is I think the wrong kind of assumption to make, or is the assumption that needs to be challenged at every step. And unfortunately, we don't challenge our assumptions that more technology is always good. We just kind of keep going down that path, even when there's good scientific evidence out there that the distracting qualities of the technology often get in the way of learning in retention and memory.
But you don't need to remember anything anymore. It's all on the internet.
Just Google it. Yeah.
Anybody else have thoughts on education and technology?
I think Nick's right. I mean, be selective.
Yeah. But the potential, you know, there is, again, like the potential is there, you know, so so it hasn't, you know, it hasn't been shown yet, but some of the online stuff does have the potential to have big impact. And one of the, you know, that's a big buzzword, you know, the online learning and things like that. But what I see in some schools they're starting to do is the flipped classroom, mm-hmm. which, you know, where the kids watch a pre-recorded lecture at home just like they would have, you know, studied their book before, and then they go in the classroom and they work through the problems with the teacher in the classroom. And my kids like that a lot. They say, you know, I don't have any problem understanding the lecture. It's when I'm trying to do the problem sets in my chemistry class that's when I would like to have somebody to talk to. So I think there is, you know, the technology is evolving, you know, online lectures. There's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, because of the internet could really change things. I mean, I'm sure, you know people that use Khan Academy when they're trying to brush up on their math and you know, there's a lot of potential.
Yeah, I mean, our 7-year-old goes to a private school in San Francisco, and it's a STEM-focused school. And there, you know, the T in the technology is actually relatively small by choice. I mean, it's there, but it's not pervasive. And a lot of the learning and belief sort of behind the school is that in a society where information is available constantly, that the real skill set is going to be inquiry-based thinking, right? And how do we teach that? And so all the classes are taught around how do you think, which I think gets back to sort of Nick's point, which is we really need to teach people how to think in this world of constantly flooded, where you're constantly flooded with information. So this inquiry-based thinking methodology, you know, gives me hope.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. Here's another interesting question about kids. My 12-year-old loves playing video games and Skyping with his friends online. When his computer time is up, he's often combative or resentful for a while. He's also a voracious ebook reader, however, and when he's done reading, he's more conversationally calm and contemplative. They're both screens, they're both technology, but the results are very different. Thoughts?
I certainly think that one of the great things about kids, and I think this is even more so than unfortunately with adults, is that they're naturally very flexible in shifting between different styles of thinking. It's when you're young that your brain is the most malleable, and I think so. You can see a kid who's, you know, going crazy with information overloaded at one moment, and then the next moment they'll be totally immersed in a novel. And I think that's great. And I certainly think, you know, you can have that experience reading a book on a screen. I'm not sure it's as easy as reading a book on paper, but you can certainly lose yourself in a book. And so I think that's what we should be encouraging, encouraging kids and encouraging ourselves as well, is to make sure that we consciously engage in different modes of thinking during the course of a day. And some of those modes have to be very attentive thinking, where we're concentrating on one thing, and that means turning off the stimulus that comes through phones and computers and other things. And you know, it's easy to say that. I think it's getting harder and harder as we adapt ourselves to the technology and as our job, you know, as our employer sends out messages that you need to be online all the time, and our schools send out messages you need to be online all the time, and our social lives go on online. It gets harder and harder to back away, but certainly for kids and for everyone else, if we consciously do that and turn things off for a while and calm down our minds, then we can maintain the balance in thinking that I think is so important.
In our home, we have a no screens policy Monday through Friday. Now, I have a 4 and a 7-year-old. I don't know how long I'm going to be able to hold on to this, right? Because they're going to start getting, you know, computers at school soon. But it's for this exact reason. It's because, and it was the reason I built KidStar, was because of the aggressive behavior that the children would exhibit when we would try and get back the screen from them. And if it just isn't there, then you don't have that. And life is wonderful. Now, the issue with it, though, is it takes an extraordinary amount of energy. It takes very active parenting to actually communicate with your kid and keep them busy and keep them entertained and engaged in reality when they know in the back of their mind that there's this screen that could be pinging their dopamine. So it does take a lot of active parenting. But
I'm just curious, are you seeing your 7-year-old friends starting to have cell phones and smartphones and stuff?
Yes. Yeah. And that's just our family policy.
Yeah.
Right. We'll see how long I can keep that. Talk to me in 2 years.
I'd be interested in the audience, people that have, you know, had kids during the period of time when they could have had cell phones.
We're really not set up to pass microphones in the audience.
No, I just thought you could have a show of hands like you
did. The radio listeners are going to have trouble with it.
Yeah. Hello, radio listeners.
Nick, that doesn't fit into your future perspective on automation of everything?
it kind of does. My next book's about automation and how more and more we're doing everything in our work lives and everything in our personal lives with the aid of or through a computer, and what that does for our development of talent and skill and our sense of what talent and skill is and why it's important. Which is not a criticism of what you're doing, but it just shows that very quickly we're going to be able to use computers to do very subtle intellectual type of tasks that we until recently assumed were the kind of the space in which human beings would never be pushed out of. And
yeah, but so photography is different than painting?
That's true. but both the
synthesized music is different than playing an instrument.
Right, but if you look at the history of work and skill development stuff, a lot of it took place in you'd have a particular job which you, or and this could be a hobby too, that you did in a specialized way that required specialized knowledge, that had lots of psychomotor skills part of it, had manipulating the world. And more of those things now are being done through software, through computer screens.
Augmentation.
And you lose some of that heterogeneity of talent, and instead you get more and more homogeneous sort of tasks. And I think that over the long run, that begins to narrow the capabilities of human beings because we're not pushed to interact with the world.
I'm not sure if I believe it. I mean, if you look at like photography, for example, how it changed, you know, and film, how it changed, it made new creative possibilities and created new kinds of innovation. So a lot of the stuff that the early, you know, like modern artists like Picasso and stuff were doing, were kind of stimulated by this fact that you could kind of take images and rework them and things. And
Zach, I see you nodding.
Yeah,
over there.
I mean, I guess one of the questions we should be asking is, if we're concerned about the future, is sort of what is the basis of competitive advantage for individuals, for nations, for companies, in an era, in a world where information just is free and unlimited and constantly there. I mean, I would posit that it sort of reverts to something more primal, and that is emotional competitive advantage. So your capacity to control your emotions and understand other people's emotions in a social context will even become more important in the ability for teams to create competitive advantage and think more effectively and work more effectively together. I mean, it has to be something, right? Because something will need to differentiate us, and if information's there and we're cognitively able to sort of put things together, maybe it is emotional competitive advantage that sort of drives firms.
Like singers now have access to something that track, you know, they can make a database of their own voice hitting the note the right way, and then they can be automatically tracked, and that can be substituted, that can be laid over. So people doing live performance actually can perform, you know, without being able to hit all the notes anymore. I mean, so there is that.
Is that progress?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, the technology's there, and so then the performance, you know, is about something else, right? There's new innovation. I'm not saying, you know, all kinds of augmentation are good, but also, you know, you can, again, on the social good side, you know, the prosthetic technology that's out there that's developed, you know, because of these, you know, the same technologies that you're criticizing are letting people be able to, you know, walk who couldn't have ever walked, you know, again, 50 years ago. So.
And I definitely make a complete exception for therapeutic technology that helps people, you know, cures disease or cures disabilities or whatever. I think that's a whole, that's all to the good. So I'm not trying to criticize progress along those lines.
It's a very fine line. So when I lecture on privacy, like in a big intro class, you know, I point out that Runkeeper, which lets you keep track of your exercise activity and shows you all the runs that you've been on, that's exactly the same technology that somebody else could be using to see where you've been when you might not want them to, right? So it's exactly the same exact technology.
Mm-hmm. So this is, I guess we start with Zach on this, but a couple of people have asked about neurogaming and how successful it is. Do people focus, remember, solve problems better if they use neurogaming platforms?
So neurogaming is a broad term. It can mean many things to many people. How I sort of talk about it is where the mind and body meet gameplay. And there are different types of neurogaming. There are different types of neurogames. There are therapeutic neurogames that are focused on helping people who have some type of brain deficit or disease or disorder. There are wellness neurogames that are to improve and enhance the healthy mind. There are educational neurogames that are emerging to help us figure out how to teach kids more effectively and accelerate learning. So it's a broad term to many people, you know, and, you know, are these brain fitness applications effective? Some are. Some aren't. The devil's in the details, like most things. It's an emerging space. We'll have some charlatans. We'll have other companies that are based on solid science. It's very early in the development of these tools, but I'm a firm believer that this is actually where things are going and that we'll see a blossoming of these companies and these technologies in the coming years, because this is how we're actually going to get through this morass of being constantly bombarded by meaningless information. I mean, it brings to mind, like, Twitter, right? Is this why there's so much inane talk on Twitter? Is because, you know, it's just reacting to information to make more information in many respects.
OMG, yes. Nick, you write about the fact that the big internet companies, Googles and the Facebooks, actually make money from the distracted approach to the internet. The more clicks, the more advertising value. So how much of a trend, how much of a force do you think that's going to be in the future in trying to get things into perspective?
I think it's a very big force. I mean, I think there are three different things going on. One is our natural inclination to want to be distracted, in effect. Another is the technology itself. You know, there's nothing like a high-speed computer network for delivering lots of information in lots of different forms very, very quickly. But then there's also, we also have to look at the businesses that dominate the design of the services we use. And if you look at the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, for all the good things they do, the fact is they make money the more distracted we are. The more we jump from one message to the next, the more we jump from one web page to the next, they collect more behavioral information about us, and they also get to show us more advertisements, and that's how they make money. So they're very much incented and motivated to keep us jumping around. And the worst thing for a Google or a Facebook is for somebody to disconnect and, you know, look up at the sky for a while because they're not making any money. So I do think we need to, you know, I think we need to remember that this is a very much a commercial space now, and that our experience of computers and of the online world and of social media isn't something we create for ourselves. It's something being created by profit-making companies for us, and we should be wary of that.
Anyone else have thoughts?
Wise words.
Yes, indeed. Well, I think we're probably close to our... Yes, I'm seeing the last question please sign here. And I saved this for last, but I think it could be fun. We're getting into the age of wearables. We've got Google Glass, the Internet of Things. We're just headed toward a totally connected universe. How do you think those things are going to affect the challenge of distraction in the future? Will they help us to focus? Will they help us to make something more productive about this world? Or are we a little freaked out about Google Glass? And why don't we start with Marilyn on this one?
I have to say I kind of find some of it scary, a bit scary. So, I mean, the idea, like, that the MH370 could have been hacked, that I know that could have been technically possible, that's pretty scary. Mm-hmm. You think about that with cars. I mean, all this, you know, the Internet of Things, you know, that you could have somebody, you know, something could take over your vehicle.
And make you park badly. Yes.
That would never happen to me. No. But, I think there's stuff to be wary about. Yeah. One of the things that we were just briefly talking about beforehand, which we're not supposed to mention that we talked at all beforehand, but...
That's not true. I just didn't want us to have the whole discussion beforehand.
It's about how the technology is changing so rapidly that the fact that the laws lag the technology is more and more of a problem, mm-hmm. right? So it used to be the case that the fact that there might be a 5-year lag or 10-year lag in the law, you know, the legal system catching up with the technology, that didn't used to maybe be so much of a problem, but now it seems to me like it's a real problem.
Zach, do you have thoughts on?
I mean, I actually liked Nick's response to that. He thinks it's a good thing that there's that much lag, right?
In many cases, because it slows things down a little bit, and it gives society time to wrestle with hard things. Although Marilyn's right that when you look at it from a privacy standpoint or something, it can be to the disbenefit of people if privacy laws don't account for things like Google
Glass. Yeah, I think they only just passed a law saying something about tracking children, right? Like,
yeah.
Or it's in Congress right now.
But back to your original question of augmented reality and Google Glass in the future, it's going to happen. So that's the fact we have to deal with. We've got to think about techniques and tools and technologies that we can use with these new wearable technologies to adapt to sort of a more sophisticated way of using them rather than having us just be automatons blindly using them. And I think sort of that's the finesse and that's the art of design and the beauty of persuasive technology development that we all sort of need to embrace and think about in the Valley to be able to use these technologies in a more effective and positive way going forward.
I'm not as convinced that Google Glass and other particularly, you know, head wearables or head mountables as they're horribly called, I'm not convinced that they're going to actually be popular because they are very fundamentally weird. And I think Google is counting on us all kind of becoming weirder and weirder over time. And you know, it's worked for them so far. But really having, you know, actually having overlays of information on your field of vision as you go through the day, that causes certain strains in your eyesight, in your brain and stuff. And so maybe we'll adapt to that and maybe we'll suddenly say, boy, this is great. I can, you know, have messages coming across my field of vision all day long, but I'm not entirely convinced that we're going to go for that.
When I see someone with Google Glass, I always flash to the Borg. There's just something.
Yeah, but do you remember when people started walking around with the Sony Walkman, 1984, and all of a sudden you had people that were hooked up, you know, listening to music. That was weird. And then, you know, when people started being on their cell phone with the Bluetooth mic and you're next to somebody and they start talking, and you think, oh man, this I gotta move, you know, this person. So I think that, you know, the Google Glass is, there will be people that.
Yeah, I'm probably naive, but I just hope there's some limit to weirdness we'll finally hit.
Thank you all so much. This has been a delightful conversation. Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed this evening's Silicon Valley Reads program. Again, we'd like to thank Nicholas Carr, author of The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, Zach Lynch, Executive Director of the Neurotechnology Industry Organization, Marilyn Walker, Associate Dean of Graduate Studies and Professor of Computer Science at UC Santa Cruz, and Barbara Marshman, Editorial Pages Editor at the San Jose Mercury News, and all of you for joining us. Thank you.